Welcome back to the Brew University Virtual Roundtable. I'm your host, Jeff Weaver, and today we will be discussing how to talk to your teams in difficult times. As you may well have noticed, 2020 has been a pretty challenging year. A global pandemic, an election year of tremendous polarization, riots, civil unrest, there's a lot happening, and talking about it can be difficult. As leaders, we want to address our teams. Silence, as we know, is not a long-term option. When we fail to address our teams, they're free to make up their own stories, and those stories are never optimistic. So we must be able and willing to address difficult subjects. But it's not easy, and many leaders, even good leaders, struggle to start the conversations. So I suppose it's worth asking, why is it so difficult to talk to our teams in difficult times?
They have different views. Not necessarily having the correct answer, knowing what to say.
Oh, that's such a great point, right? We don't always know what we need to say or what the right thing to say is or what we're supposed to say or what we're allowed to say. And that uncertainty around how do we talk about this? What is it we're supposed to say? How are we supposed to approach a topic or what can or cannot we talk about is definitely a reason why these difficult topics can be so difficult. Thanks, Steve. That's a great one. What else?
Knowing how the person's going to react once you bring up the difficult, conversation with them.
Yes, definitely. Great call, Albert. That's absolutely a big part of it, is just that uncertainty around what is this going to create? What kind of reaction am I going to get? And I think uncertainty is at the heart of a lot of why difficult topics can be seen as difficult. I think all of these are exactly right and definitely on the track and definitely a big part of it. It's this uncertainty around what can we say, what can't we say, what's the right thing to say, how are people going to react when we talk about these things, etc. But I also think that if you take all of those and you boil them down even further, what we're afraid of and what makes difficult topics difficult is that difficult topics have an inherent conflict about them. Right? We don't know what the other person's going to say. We don't know what we're allowed to say. There's conflict built into these topics. And because oftentimes these topics are personal and wildly differing in opinions, that's why we have such a range of conflicting viewpoints. And we know the conflict is inherent there. And when it comes to conflict, what it really then comes down to is trust. Because at the heart of it, trust or the lack thereof is always what makes things difficult to talk about. Topics that are inherently conflicting require the most amount of trust to be discussed. So let's think about that for a sec from the five dysfunctions perspective. If you go back to our five dysfunctions of a team that we always talk about, there's that layer called the lack of conflict. It's the second layer in our pyramids. So we know that a lack of conflict, an absence of conflict, or unhealthy conflict in general, is a sign of a team that is dysfunctional. And certainly a lot of these conversations feel dysfunctional at their heart. So when we find that we have a lack of conflict or bad conflict or unhealthy conflict going on, where do we look to really make sure that we can solve that problem? We start one layer deeper by looking at the team's trust. Because the only way for conflict to take place in a healthy and productive way is when there is a solid foundation of trust underneath it. And the more conflicting the topic, the more inherent conflict there is in a topic, the more trust we're going to need in order to be able to talk about that particular topic. And so that often can be seen as the underlying issue that really speaks to why are some of these topics that are difficult to talk about so difficult? It's because they require the most amount of trust between people to even have a conversation in the first place. And I think that's the place we should start when we think about how do we approach this, is what is the relationship we have with the person or persons that we're about to address, and how do we reaffirm and make sure that we're standing on a solid foundation of trust before we talk about these more difficult things. So let's talk about trust for a moment. Let's look at Lencioni's definition of trust. Lencioni says that trust is between teammates and amongst teams is the belief that each other's intentions are good and that there's no reason to be protective or guarded. Intentions are good, no reason to be protective or guarded. That really does speak to a lot of why difficult conversations are so difficult. We're protected, we're guarded, right? We don't know what we want to say. We don't know how other people are going to react. So we're coming into the situation in a very guarded, closed off manner. Why? Because we haven't made sure that we've got the foundation of trust that we need for this particular conversation. Trust is also talked about when, you know, we talk about it in Great Manager, we talk about Simon Sinek. And he says it this way: do you believe what I believe? And when it comes to conflict topics or topics that have a lot of inherent conflict in them, again, I don't always know what you believe. I don't know coming into this that we're on the same page, that we agree and think the same way. And because I don't know that, there's an inherent lack of trust built into that conversation, because that's what's needed for trust to exist. I have to believe, I have to know that you believe what I believe. And if we don't believe the same things, trust is going to be that much more difficult. And without trust, the conflict falls even further. So it all starts and stems from that inherent trust base that we have in these relationships and with our teams as it goes. And trust, of course, is that commonality. It's that, what do we have in common? Do we stand in the same place? It's why we spend so much time in Great Manager talking about building a foundation of trust with your teams, getting across to them that these are our core values as a company, and we believe them, and we need you to believe them, because when conflicts arise, this is what we're all going to fall back on. That we believe our employees are our most important asset. And as long as we believe it and they believe it and everybody knows we believe it, they can bring forward challenging conversations. They can challenge that what we're doing is not in our employees' best interest, because they know, they believe that we want to do that. And maybe we've just missed the mark. We want to provide a safe workplace. If our employees believe that, then even when we miss the mark and do something that isn't necessarily the safest approach, we can correct ourselves, because we have no problem speaking up and saying, hey, you believe in a safe workplace, I believe in a safe workplace, and this here, this isn't safe, so let's discuss it and talk about it. And it's that safety of knowing we want the same ultimate outcome that allows for that conflict conversation to go pretty smoothly. Right? There's not a lot of conflict when it comes to doing safe things or doing the right things, because we really well know that we all want to achieve the same outcome. But in these types of conversations, in difficult conversations, conflict conversations, certain topics, we're challenged by, I don't know that I believe what you believe. I don't know that you have the same set of values and the same outlook and the same perspective. And so that's where we have to start. We have to go back to that trust level and find that commonality. And it's going to be tough, because in some topics, we're never going to be able to achieve true commonality or true complete total trust, right? When we're talking about topics like religion or politics or economy or things that are of an inherently controversial nature, what makes them so controversial? It's that you may have a very different set of beliefs than what I have. And we may not be able to reconcile those beliefs across each other. And so that's going to put us in a position where trust is always going to be at a disadvantage. In order to overcome that, we have to make sure that we focus on and build upon all the places around that where there is common ground. And so that can be part of the challenge of the ongoing conversations we need to have, is you've got to find ways to reaffirm trust in other areas, even if you're not going to necessarily agree on some of them. Right. So if we want to talk about a topic where we know we have a different set of beliefs, it's going to be incumbent upon us to be able to start with what we have in common and finish with what we have in common. We both want to achieve the same positive outcome. We both want both of us to, you know, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, or whatever it is. This is what we have in common. This is what we can agree on. And then start working through the areas where maybe we have those disagreements. So trust. Trust is at the core and the foundation, because more often than not, conflict conversations begin and are hampered by two parties who don't know what each other believes, don't necessarily believe the same things, and therefore are at a trust disadvantage that's going to make the entire thing more difficult. You can overcome that by reaffirming the areas where you do have common ground, by reaffirming the places where you do have commonality, and acknowledging where you may not, so that it's not seen as lack of transparency, for any other term there. So, that all having been said, we understand now again that trust is the foundation to all of this. Trust is what allows us to be able to have any kind of conversations. We know that given certain topics, given certain things that, you know, that are happening in the world, or that we may have to address with our teams, whether, again, it's, you know, coronavirus or just the state of the market and where's the business headed at any given time, you know, sometimes we don't always know that we believe the same things. So how do we overcome that if trust is never going to be completely possible? How do we deal with those situations? Now, knowing what the root cause is, we can take some action, but then we still have to have conflict in an area where we may not have complete trust in each other. So how do we approach that? Well, let's talk about some basic conflict management techniques and conflict discussion techniques that can help you along those ways. Because conflict isn't inherently a bad thing. Remember, conflict is not something that we're trying to avoid. Conflict is not something that we're trying to diffuse. It's not something we try to make go away. It's just something that we need to address and resolve in a healthy manner and to be focused on positive and productive conflict as opposed to the unhealthy, unproductive conflict that many people get tracked down in. So how does that happen? Why can't we get to the heart of a conversation, talk about what's really important or what's really at the heart of our conflict? Well, it oftentimes is because we get stuck in the outer rims of extraneous nonsense, distraction conflict, as opposed to the good center of the issue, healthy conflict that we really want to focus on. So I'll give you guys a little more on that. So Lencioni, back in our Five Dysfunctions, talked about the conflict at the source model that he had that I think illustrates this really well. And he says that at the source of any disagreement or any problem is good, solid, healthy conflict that we want people to be able to have, but that oftentimes that conflict is surrounded by or hampered by layers of unhealthy distraction issues that prevent us from getting to the real conflict at the source and keep us hung up on this outside edge. He said, if you're trying to hit the bullseye of conflict, you've got to hit it where it lives, not in all these extraneous areas. So what are they? Well, let's start here on the outermost edge, because that is the stuff that is the farthest away from real conflict and the most distraction, nonsense kind of conflict that we can talk about. And that's what he calls personal obstacles. Personal obstacles are things that we are unable to get past in ourselves that prevent us from having positive, healthy conflict or dealing in a difficult situation with others. These are the biases, the prejudices, the other intrinsic limits we have that are keeping us from engaging with people in a positive and trust-based way. Now, this is tough. It seems like something that ought to be easy to get past, but it's not. It's very tough because this is built up over years of experience for us, and it's sort of wired into the way our brains are designed to work. Our brains have evolved over tens of thousands of years, millions of years, and whatnot. We're pattern recognition machines. Ultimately, fundamentally, the way our minds have grown up is to absorb patterns, recognize patterns, and then apply those patterns towards future ideas. So we know what a bumblebee is because we've seen hundreds of thousands of bumblebees. And so the next bumblebee we see, it looks just like all the ones we've seen before. That's a bumblebee. Right? This is how we know what things are. We know how to move ourselves through time and space and not bump into objects because we've been spending our entire lives learning how to avoid objects as we walk around. We're still not perfect at these things, as proven by how often I trip over stuff. But nonetheless, right? We're more likely to be able to walk through our own house at night without tripping over something than somebody else's because there's that pattern recognition. We have a bias for the type of path through our house that keeps us safe. It's an evolutionary response, and it's not good or bad. It's just the truth of what we are. We have been programmed, our brains have been built up to look at things, look the way we've done things in the past, apply them towards the future, and it works for us. It works for us so well that our brains built themselves around it, and it survived the species. Avoid these plants because they're poisonous. Plants that look like this are poisonous. You don't eat the poisonous plants. The species moves on. And so this is how we're wired intrinsically. But that intrinsic wiring is a big problem when it comes to personal obstacles because our own personal biases are always there. And if they're not serving us well in a situation, they can become a stumbling block. They're that thing we slam our toe into in the middle of the night that we thought was there and turned out shouldn't have been there. And so we have to be aware of where they are. So some of them are obvious. Some personal biases are obvious and nonsensical, right? So when we think about things like gender bias or race bias or age bias, these are things that are real easy to point out. Right? It's real easy to know who the people are that are like, oh, those stupid millennials, they don't know anything and they only want to worry about themselves. And oh, yeah, okay, boomer, go try and tweet that out. Why don't you? Like, an age bias is a real easy thing to understand because we see it quickly and we understand how nonsensical that could be, right? Because is technology adaptness an age thing? No. But there's enough of it out there that we create these little stereotypes, which are just another form of bias. And those personal biases lock us in and sort of become a stumbling block. Some of them, however, some of those personal biases have nothing to do with the obvious stuff, and it becomes a deeper-seated bias that we, again, we have to become aware of because they limit us. For example, if every time I have to deal with the sales team, my experience is that salespeople are just always focused on one thing and one thing only, and that's getting sales done. And if I bring them anything else, they don't want to hear about it. Well, if I come into every conversation with a salesperson with that bias built in, I'm bringing that personal obstacle to the table, and it might become a limiting factor. You're never going to get rid of them. Let me just be perfectly clear. Our brains are wired this way. So you're never going to get rid of your biases, but you can become aware of them. You can take the time to be self-reflective and say, what are the personal biases that I bring to the table? And how do I make sure they don't become a limiting factor in a particular conflict? Because if I walk into this conflict and I assume that everybody in this department is going to behave this way, then I'm creating an obstacle before I even get started. And that's that outside rim of personal obstacles. I've created a personal obstacle to conflict before we even get started. And it's hanging way out there away from reality, but it is what it is. So that's personal biases, personal obstacles. They are what keep us the farthest away from healthy conflict. And we've got to be aware of them because personal obstacles are a real thing for all of us. It's only through self-awareness and self-reflection that we're able to overcome them. All right, the next layer in are relationship obstacles. Relationship obstacles are the obstacles we've created between us and others based on a history, based on a legacy, based on past events. So if I have always, every time I deal with this person, they are difficult to deal with. They are, they're a pain in my butt. They don't like to help me out. They are just the worst. If that's the history I'm bringing to this, then I am bringing a relationship obstacle into every interaction with that person. The more difficult the conversation, the more difficult that conflict is going to be to have because we've got this history and this legacy built up around it. So imagine trying to have a difficult conversation with someone who you've never had a non-difficult conversation with, right? That's going to be way more difficult than having a difficult conversation with someone that you have a great relationship with. Relationship obstacles keep us from being able to even get close to real conflict because we're too hung up on the conflicts of the past. Very similar to personal, but oftentimes they're shared by both parties, right? So in relationship obstacles, and it's usually built around legacy events. It's I've had a terrible history with this person. We don't get along. And so I just know that every interaction with them is going to be a challenge. And it's at a person-to-person level, not a category of people. I'm not painting everybody with one brush, but I am saying for this individual, this person, every time we've dealt with each other, it's been a challenge, so I know the next time's going to be as well. You don't know that. That's the intrinsic bias that you got to overcome is you don't know that. It always has been? Sure. Is that a reason to be concerned going in? Absolutely. But should you automatically put someone at a deficit and deny them a certain amount of trust based on the fact that they've done something the same way over and over again? Maybe, but if you do, you're definitely creating an additional obstacle you're going to have to overcome in order to be able to have healthy conflict with that person. So understanding relationship obstacles as a problem will go a long way towards helping you know when you're focusing on, are we arguing about the thing or are we arguing about the history of every other thing we've ever argued about? The real challenge with legacy events and relationship obstacles is that they tend to compound like interest over time, right? If I have constantly, every time, had issue after issue with someone, eventually I'm going to get tired of dealing with them and I'm going to reduce the relationship to something that I just don't want to deal with. I'm going to avoid this person and that conflict will disappear because the trust will have disappeared and we just won't even attempt to have it in the first place. And so the best prevention, the best thing you can do to deal with relationship obstacles is to address them when they happen and then make sure that you are willing to let go, forgive, and forget on things in the past so that you can move forward. Because the longer you let relationship conflicts build up, the longer you're hanging on to this is how it was before, the more that is going to compound to the point where it becomes unrecoverable because trust just gets totally broken. So relationship obstacles are definitely a reason why it can be tough to have conversations with people. I've always had tough conversations with this person. They're always combative. They're always difficult with me. I don't want to have the next one. It's a relationship obstacle. You're going to have to find a way to clear the air with that person, or you're going to have to be willing to forgive and move forward and be willing to give them the opportunity to grow that maybe this time around it will be different. But until you get past those relationship obstacles, you're not even going to be able to get to the healthy conflict down at the source.
Do you have any recommendations on how to get over that type of conflict with someone who you always, always have a conflict with?
Every situation can be a bit different, and there's definitely some challenges that you'll need to look at the particular history you have. But that said, there's a few things you can do. First of all, you've got to be willing to own your part of whatever relationship challenges exist, because it takes two to tango in every interpersonal relationship, whether it's, you know, what, no matter the relationship, if you are interacting with somebody else and you've got a challenge with someone else, you are half the problem. The good news is that means you can be half the solution, but you've got to own your part in it first. If you continue to live in a world where you were right and they were wrong and that was that, you're never going to get past that. You're going to have to start by saying, well, what did I contribute? What can I have done better? And apologize and own that and show some accountability. Very often, that willingness to demonstrate the accountability and own your half of it will invite someone else to show the same vulnerability back. Trust requires vulnerability. So if you can't be vulnerable, if you can't admit the mistakes you've made, they won't either. And remember, I always say in these situations, leaders go first. So if you want this relationship to improve, you may have to be the first one to make that overture. The second part I would say is, make sure to take the time to intentionally invite someone to overcome those issues and have that conversation. Don't wait until the next conflict starts to deal with the conflicts of the past. If you know you've got legacy relationship issues with someone, find a time, and we'll talk about this in a second. Environmental obstacles can be their own problem. You can't have a fight about the last fight in the middle of the next fight. So find a time and a place that is neutralized and away from other conflicts and address the old ones to be able to put them to bed. And the third thing I'll say, and then I'll open it back up, is I would also say in these situations, declaring your intentions to move forward in a positive way is the real key to it. Because again, trust is built on, I believe that I understand what you believe and that we're working towards common goals. So in addition to owning your part of the conflict, you have to be willing to say, I know we've had issues in the past, but I genuinely want to move forward and these are my intentions. Your actions will have to match your words, but if you don't make that declaration of I want things to be better, I want things to change, then you're not even really giving that person an opportunity to engage the right way. So own your part, have the conversation in the right time and place, and make a declaration that you want to change and that you can invite the other person to change with you. They may not, but at least that is everything you can control, because again, you are half of that relationship. Great question, Tanya. Thanks. Other questions around relationship obstacles?
Just an add on. So after those three steps are taken, is it okay to cut ties with that toxic relationship? I mean, sometimes I think we draw on too long with some team members that those ties, those toxic people continue to linger instead of taking care of that part of those issues.
Yeah, that's a great thought, Gary, and I'll jump into that a little further by recommending. There's a book by Dr. Henry Cloud called Boundaries that is fantastic on this topic. If you're dealing with a lot of toxic relationships that you want to know some really good strategies to deal with toxic relationships, Boundaries by Dr. Henry Cloud is a fantastic book for that. But yes, the fundamental answer or thought I'd have is there is, I agree. There is a point at which you have to call a relationship, declare it toxic and lost, and cut ties and move on. I do think the responsible thing to do is, to the previous point, you got to make your effort first. You got to know that you did everything you could do, and then you've got to sort of, you know, declare bankruptcy and move forward as best you can. That is a whole nother down the rabbit hole discussion that I could have about, you know, how you manage and retain people, and when do you do that in terms of if it's your employee versus if it's a peer versus if it's someone you work for. So I won't go too far down that rabbit hole, but as a broad stroke, yes, there's always a point at which you've done everything you can do. Your half of the relationship is willing to change. Their half is unwilling to change. That's, you know, it's relationships are not like not launching a nuclear missile. You don't need both keys to make them work. If one person chooses not to participate in a relationship, it's going to be fundamentally broken. That doesn't necessarily change the fact you may have still worked together, and that's a different a problem for a different day. But yeah, there is a point at which you'll want to cut that off and move forward. Check out Boundaries by Dr. Henry Cloud. It's a really great book on how to address those exact type of issues. All right, so personal and relationship obstacles are about ourselves and the history we have with others, and they are the farthest away from real issues. Now we're getting closer to the issues themselves, and this particular one is oftentimes important but overlooked, and that's environmental issues. environmental obstacles are time and place. And environmental obstacles can have a huge impact on how difficult a conversation is to have, right? So you've got to take consideration when you're dealing with difficult messages, when you're delivering difficult news to a team, when you're talking about a difficult subject, you have to be aware of the environment that you're in having that conversation. You may not be able to change the environment. For example, right now, we're living through a worldwide pandemic. It's very tough to talk about a pandemic in the midst of a pandemic because we don't all know what's going on. News is changing. Information is changing constantly. We learn things. We unlearn things. And so trying to be certain in a time of uncertainty is very challenging. That's an environmental obstacle. We are in an uncertain world regarding this pandemic. And so having certain conversations can be tough. We are in a time of extreme political polarization and national strife over a lot of political issues. That's going to make any discussion around those issues extra difficult because people are already hyped up and tweaked out and stressed out more than at most other times. So that's the environment that we're trying to have these conversations in. That can contribute tremendously to a particular conflict. So you have to be cognizant of that and address that going in because, again, it's real easy to let the environment overrun the real heart of a particular conflict. I'll give you a couple of examples that I can think of, and then I'll see if you guys want to ask about any others. But imagine, for example, that if you're trying to talk about the budget, it's a lot easier to talk about the budget in budget season than mid-year when we're already locked into a plan and trying to make our numbers. Right? That's an environmental obstacle to budgeting. If I want to get money for a new project and I'm bringing it up halfway through the budget cycle where we've already locked in our figures and we're just trying to make our plan for the year, it's going to be a lot more difficult to have that conversation or resolve that conflict than leading into budget season where everything's still sort of up in the air and we have the opportunity to make change. Simple example, but it's an example of how the environment makes a huge impact on how that conflict is going to go. Another good example that I always joke about is I don't do training in March. Why? Because the environment around here in March has nothing to do with training. It is not amenable to the training world. You guys have spring break, you've got St. Pat's, you've got spring training, you've got so much going on in the month of March that is driving get things done and in the business. We're usually short-staffed and trying to get everything out the door that to propose or bring forward training projects or things that take away from the day-to-day run of the business at that time of year is the most difficult. So I can avoid a lot of conflict by not proposing things in March. And if I'm going to have to propose something in March, I have to know going into it that there's an environmental obstacle to overcome, which is the business is at its busiest. So these are things that you have to be aware of because oftentimes the conflict you're having is not really about the thing. It's about this isn't the time or place for that thing. This trickles all the way down to simply how you deliver a message to your team. There is a time and a place and a way to deliver a message. If you put something in an email or a text, that's a different tone and a different level of importance than it is if you, you know, bring them together, put them on a phone call, sit them in a room to tell them something important. So as you're considering the message, and if you know a message is going to be in, you know, a conflicting or difficult message to deliver or for people to receive, you really got to consider, what is the right environment for this? How do I want to deliver this message in a way that will be best received in terms of tone of voice and time and temperament and giving people the right space and the right amount of time to hear that message where they aren't going to be distracted or upset simply because of what's going on around us and not just about the thing itself? Environmental obstacles are overcome in one of two ways. You can either avoid them by moving your messaging or your conflict to a time when it's appropriate and the environment's amenable, or if you can't avoid the conflict happening when it happens, you have to be willing to acknowledge the environment that it's in. You've got to be willing to say, I know this isn't the best time or place to have this conversation, or I understand this is a difficult time to have this talk, but we also have to have this talk. Acknowledgement, transference first, acknowledgement second will go towards defeating or at least diffusing in many cases those environmental obstacles. Questions on environmental obstacles? A little more straightforward to understand, so I don't spend too much time trying to over-explain it, but I want to make sure you guys do see the importance it has, because so often we lose the message. We find ourselves not being well-received, simply because of the environment and not because of what we're actually trying to say. It's not what we're trying to say or what we're trying to have conflict about. It's that the timing or the place or whatnot isn't right. So environmental obstacles are an important one to make sure we get out of the way. The last one, the closest to the conflict, but still not the conflict, are what we call informational obstacles. Informational obstacles have become a very interesting topic in the last few years. I don't think Pat Lencioni, when he first put this forward, had any idea just how hot a topic informational obstacles was going to become in the world. The definition of informational obstacles is making sure that everyone involved has the same set of facts and definitions in order to discuss or debate a topic. Because if we don't agree on the facts, then we're going to be in conflict relentlessly, not about our own conflict, not about the actual conflict, but about the facts surrounding the conflict. This is the very heart of what is often referred to as fake news these days, right? The idea that your facts and my facts are different facts. And so we're spending all of our time debating which facts are true and which facts are not true and what's right and what's wrong in terms of the information, none of which is the actual conflict itself. It's just detail around that conflict that we have to get right. Because if we can't agree whether the number is up or down, then we really are debating that and not whether up or down is good or up or down is right or how we're going to change it. So informational obstacles are the closest to truth and yet still an obstacle. And this is one that can go a long way towards really making sure that when you have a difficult conversation or are dealing with difficult messages, that if you get this stuff right, if you take the time to get this stuff right, it makes a huge impact. So how do we deal with making sure that informational obstacles don't get in our way? It's important to take the time to get everybody into agreement about the facts of a conflict before we start in on how to resolve that conflict. Because if we don't, like I said, the issue becomes, well, if I think the numbers going down is a good thing, then I don't want to move in any particular direction. If you think the numbers going down are a bad thing, you may want to make all kinds of change. But if we don't even agree on what the numbers are doing, then we're never going to agree on how we should react, et cetera. And so it's good to have those kinds of discussions up front. It's good to define your terms up front. Before you deal with a conflicting situation, bring the facts that you intend to use to the table and give people an opportunity to speak to them or look at them or understand them and ask questions about it, because that will go a long way towards making sure that we're all back on the same page when it comes to actually then debating the facts and not just the ideas around the facts. So, if you're bringing a conflict or an issue to the meeting, make sure that you've got whatever information you're going to bring, you've got copies of it for everyone. And it'll give people time and an opportunity to review that, right? These are the numbers I'm working off of. Make sure everybody in the group has those numbers up front and can look at them and can challenge them beforehand so that that doesn't become the whole precipice or purpose of the meeting. So informational obstacles are a huge, huge issue. Now, when it comes to some stuff, and I wish I could tell you that data and numbers were the easy ones. They're not anymore. But, data and numbers, in theory, we can eventually get to an agreement. Some other things you'll need to think about when it comes to informational obstacles are simple things like definitions. What constitutes, progress versus what constitutes going backwards. We see this a lot. I'm trying not to get hyper-political today, obviously, but I think this is a good example of where politics at least can be illustrative, so pardon me for diving a bit here. But we see this a lot about the science around things like, should we all be wearing face masks or not? There are some people, doctors and experts, saying yes. There are some people that are doctors and experts who are saying no. We don't even know which experts to go with anymore. The CDC is changing their mind all the time. The World Health Organization has said multiple different things. Regardless of who you want to believe or who you think may or may not be right, the truth of the matter is what we really have is a lot of people in expert positions, well-researched, smart people who are saying wildly different stuff. For whatever reason, doesn't much matter, because if we can't all agree on the basic facts and understanding, you can see why we have so much conflict around something like wearing a mask. If the experts and the people we trust or are supposed to be able to trust can't tell us what the facts are, then there's no chance we're going to be able to talk about what is or isn't or what should or shouldn't be. That's on a big scale. On a small scale, like I said, it can come down to something as simple as disagreeing over how we got to a certain number. You know, what is our particular percent of this particular metric? If we're getting our numbers and our data from different places, if our formulas are slightly off of each other, we'll spend more time debating, are we up 5% or are we up 7% or are we down 3% than we will actually debating what we should do to move our numbers the way we want them to go. And so that's informational obstacles in a nutshell. Questions on informational obstacles? Again, the trick to overcoming these is going to be you've got to get everybody involved in the conflict to agree on terms and definitions. You've got to get everybody in the conflict to go, okay, when we say this, when we say gross profit, this is how we're calculating it. And when we say margin, this is what we mean. And, it, you know, as long as everybody in the debate agrees to the terms and agrees to use the same set of information and data, you'll overcome these obstacles. But it is definitely one of the most challenging things right now, especially if you're talking politics or national debates on big issues, because often these issues have terrible data and the science is all over the place and there is no definitive answer. And so we'll spend all of our time spun out on informational obstacles rather than dealing with the heart of real issues. But that leads us to the conflict at the source. And once we overcome all of those obstacles, now we're down to the source of, well, what do we actually do or what are we actually trying to achieve? And that's where, again, we go all the way back to where we started on trust. And as leaders, our job is to say, okay, here's our ultimate goal. Here's our values. Here's our beliefs. We're trying to achieve X, Y, or Z. And we can now have a debate cleared of all these other obstacles that's completely in and around the how do we best achieve that in a way that is productive for everyone and free of all these other hamperings. So overcoming those obstacles gets you to having that conflict at the source. All right. So you've got your information, you got your obstacles cleared. You've got a foundation of trust. You still have to have the difficult conversations. So what are some other things that you can do in order to make that happen? I'm going to give you a few more thoughts and then I'm going to take questions and answer anything else you want to know. A few more thoughts on it are, number one, it's really important. Really important when dealing with difficult conversations or difficult topics to check your ego and check your humility and show empathy. Oftentimes, it's not in what we're saying, it's in how we're saying it, right? Body language, tone of voice, these things account for so much more than the words we use. So you have to consider as a leader, how am I presenting this message in a way that is going to be best received by my audience? Am I making sure that my meaning and my intent are coming through? And oftentimes that means you need to find a method of communication that gives a chance for, again, tone of voice, facial expressions, body language to be present. Email, text, written communication lack empathy. They lack emotion. No one can see that you care about something on the written page. So when you need to show those things, you need to find a way to communicate that lets you show those things. A voicemail is always going to be better than an email when it comes to a difficult message because I can hear it in their voice that they care about what they're telling me. They're showing empathy. Maybe there's sympathy for me in this difficult message they're having to receive. If you take the human emotion out, when you lose touch with that little bit of humanity that comes from interpersonal communication, you put yourself at a disadvantage in a difficult message because it comes off as cold, it comes off as disconnected, and that definitely is going to make a difficult conversation more difficult. People want to feel cared about. We're still, at the end of the day, all human beings. We want to have connections with others. We're social creatures. So you've got to find a way to deal with these things, and you've got to be willing to check your ego and check your humility in order to do that. If you come into it trying to win, if you approach conversations, difficult conversations, any conversations as a point scoring exercise, then you're inherently coming in at a disadvantage because, again, back to trust, I want to believe that we're on the same team. I want to know that we're in it for the same things and we're winning together. If I think you're in this to beat me out, if I think you're in it to win it, and that means I have to be the loser in order for you to be the winner, there's no trust. But if I believe that you're in it because you want us to both come out the other end successful, then that's going to help instill the trust that you need to have the difficult conversations be productive. So never let human empathy, never let personal communications and connection come out of the mix. Take the time to deliver messages or deal with difficult topics in a way that reminds people that you still are connected to them person to person and shows the emotion. Trust is vulnerability. It's the willingness to say, I'm here with you. I understand it. I have sympathy. I have empathy. And tone of voice, facial expressions go so far in being able to communicate that, especially better than you would get coming from strictly a written word. So choose your communication methods carefully and make sure that you pick ones that allow you to demonstrate that human connection, that empathy, that consideration. Check the ego. Don't try to win conversations, especially difficult ones. It's not about that. When we're delivering tough messages, it's got to be about getting everybody to the same page and to the right outcome.
Joe, would you recommend having, maybe running that by someone? Let's say you're having a conversation, because some of us have, you know, faces that don't show empathy all the time. So would you recommend maybe speaking to like a coworker or something like that, saying, okay, this is how I'm going to say this. Tell me what I'm doing wrong.
Yes, definitely. Great, great, great thought. Thank you for bringing it up, Tanya. Absolutely. I would say, you know, partnering with someone to deliver a message before you deliver a message can be a great way. And again, that starts with that, that personal self-awareness, that recognition that, hey, you know what, these are not messages that I'm always great at delivering. I don't always come off empathetic, or I don't always come off as concerned. And so maybe I need to practice that conversation one time, or maybe I just need to be hyper aware going into it. How am I going to get across that empathy or that concern when I deliver this message? But yes, absolutely. If it's something you know you struggle with, partnering with somebody else and just saying, let me run this past you, let me try this out, will definitely a great way that you can do that in order to get some comfort with delivering more difficult or sensitive topic messages or feedback. So my final thought then for you guys, and I know we're getting close to the end of our time, my final thought for you, it really comes down to authenticity. And I know one of the things we talked about at the top of this and I mentioned was, how do I deal with what's the right thing to say? I don't know what the right thing to say is, or I'm afraid to say the wrong thing. The truth of the matter is, the more difficult the conversation, the more difficult the situation. And certainly, again, when it comes to things like a pandemic or civil unrest or whatnot, none of us have the right answers. None of us knows with any definitiveness or certainness what the right thing to do is. You know, I'm here every day with the team that is deeply involved in dealing with all these different COVID issues that we're facing. We don't know the right answers. We've got teams of experts, and they're giving us new information on a minute-by-minute basis sometimes. There isn't a right answer. And so if you're worried about, I have to have the right answer, I have to have the right thing to say, I have to have the perfect thing to say, then you're always going to be hung up on these types of difficult conversations, because there may never be a perfect or a right thing to say. And this is one of those times where I think the most important thing to remember is, don't let perfect get in the way of good or done. Be authentic, be genuine, be sincere, and that alone is going to be okay. It's okay to say what you believe to be the right thing now, and it's okay to change your mind later. Having that humility and that honesty to just say, you know what, I'm going to tell you this today. I think this is right. This is the best information I've got today. If it changes tomorrow, I'll tell you tomorrow that it changed. But if you approach conversations, if you worry about, well, I have to say the perfect right thing or I can't say anything, then the real problem is you end up more often than not saying nothing, because we're never going to achieve perfect. We're never going to have the perfect thing to say. And when we say nothing, we leave a vacuum of information. And what do teams do when we don't give them information? What do we do in an absence of information? We make up stories. And the stories we make up are worse than the truth. So when it comes to my final thought on, well, what's the right thing to say? What am I allowed to say? As a manager, as a leader, what am I allowed to say? What's the right thing to say? Do I need to toe a company position on certain things? My real advice to you guys is this: be authentic, be genuine, be honest, be humble. If you have the answer, tell them. If you're not sure that you have the answer, say that. Be willing to say, I don't know. Be willing to say, let me find out. Be willing to say, this is my opinion. Not the company's position, not anybody, it's my opinion. And be willing to change your mind and be willing to say you were wrong when you were. That over time, that consistency of humility and authenticity is going to build up a level of trust with your teams that's going to make difficult conversations increasingly easier. It's those managers, those leaders, those individuals who never wrong, always know what I'm talking about, I've always got it, everything I say is perfect, and those are the ones that we don't trust because we know better. We know that nobody's perfect. We know that nobody doesn't make mistakes. We know that people change their minds. Be authentic. If you can't be exactly right, or if you can't be perfect, be authentic. And that alone will take you as far as possible. And I've worked here now for 8 years, and I know a lot of you guys have worked here a lot longer than that. And one thing I've never seen us do is I've never seen us hang someone out to dry who was genuinely trying to do the right thing, say the right thing, or be the right way and be first choice. If you guys lead from first choice, and if you're always trying to do the right things with authenticity, we're going to figure out the rest. But don't go into conversations. Don't go into the world. Don't stake your claim on, I have the answer, the right answer. That just be humble enough to say, this is my opinion. This is what I know. This is what I think to be true. Be open-minded enough to hear other points of view or admit mistakes or change your mind. And if you approach conflict not in a conflicting way, you'll find that conflict is a lot easier to navigate. The difficult messages are made easier when we don't necessarily live and die by certainty and perfection. So if that's a concern you've had, and if you're worried about, I don't know the perfect thing to say, I don't know the right thing to say, well, that's okay. Ask, or say what you know to be true now and change your mind later, and be clear and be honest, and admit when you're talking from yourself versus when you're talking from someone else, and when you're unsure, or, you know, have an opinion. Don't always state your facts as if they are, or your opinions as if they're facts. That was a line that I heard once that I loved, is someone was like, I'm just going to state all my opinions as facts and let you figure out the difference. Don't state your opinions as if they're facts. If they're your opinions, just own them. And that authenticity is going to go a tremendous way towards increasing and maintaining the trust of your teams, of your peers, of the people you work with, while at the same time making sure that we're not living in an absence of information or in a vacuum. If you've got team members that are asking difficult questions about the pandemic, if they're asking about our positions in civil unrest, if you know, we've got riots in cities that we work in, we've got, you know, health issues going on everywhere, we've got all this stuff going on. If nothing else, be willing to say, I don't know, let me find out, here's my opinion, but that's just me, and don't necessarily lock yourself into a hard line of this is the way it has to be and I'm always right, because that, I think, so much of what causes people to difficult conversations. The unwillingness of either side to try and have that commonality. We all know.